Hello and welcome to Link Set Podcast, and today I'll be sharing an interview I did with Mr. Larry Hankin. Mr. Hankin's Zoom and his internet cuts out a couple times, so just be patient with it. It just lags out. You don't miss much. And here's my interview with Mr. Larry Hankin. Hello and welcome to Link Set Podcast, and today I'll be interviewing a man who's appeared in many, many films and TV shows from the 60s up until today. He is a writer, director, Oscar nominee. It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Larry Hankin. Sir, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. That's an interesting question nowadays. I'm doing okay as long as I don't go outside.
yeah. Staying well during all the corona stuff?
Yeah. I just got to say there's only one positive thing I've come out of this. Well, two. When I go out, because I have gray hair, and I had to point that out. You didn't notice. I have a mask on, and I put on dark glasses because of the sun. I have sensitive eyes. And I wear gloves, even. So when I go out, I'm totally, protected. I'm like a tank out there, comparatively. Because I live near the beach, and nobody has anything on. Maybe a bathing suit, So I feel like an interloper because I feel, is it me? Am I the weird one? But I noticed that people nowadays, in the last 3 days, people who don't have masks, don't give a fuck, they do actually walk around me. <They're a little laughs> 6 feet. Very nice. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Why don't you wear a mask? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not complaining. And the other thing is, when I was sequestered way before the virus hit. So I was writing a screenplay. That's why I was sequestered.
Oh, how did that go?
COVID hit. Everybody was sequestered. So I was in an advantage. I had already, stocked my refrigerator. I was in for different reasons, but I was in. So it was kind of cool. So I finished my screenplay.
Oh, good.
Thank you. For nobody bothering me. Everybody was sequestered. Really cool.
Well, let's start at the beginning. You're from New York City, correct?
Yes, sir. Far Rockaway, Long Island, actually.
Were movies something you were always interested in growing up?
No, I wasn't interested in anything. I have ADHD. I was interested in everything.
Oh, same thing.
The only movies I was, well, I guess I was in a weird way. I mean, I wasn't interested in movies. Like, I didn't talk movies with my friends or anything like that. I generally hung out by myself most of the time. I had, a lot of friends from high school. But I did watch a lot of the New Wave, French New Wave, Truffaut, and all those French directors. I just was never into American movies for some reason. I mean, it wasn't like I was a movie buff. I just watched them. I don't know why. I think they were realer to me. They were more real. They were more human. First of all, American movies are too well lit for my taste. I like a lot of, shadows and darkness. I mean, even if it's a comedy, so yeah, I wasn't into movies, but I did watch a lot of the French New Wave.
Okay, what were some of your favorites?
Well, anything that Truffaut did. I mean, I was a big Truffaut fan. What was his name? I even have a set of it here, but the guy's name, his favorite actor. Lenoir or something. No, not Lenoir. I don't know. But Francois Truffaut did a whole thing about a guy growing up, his love life growing up, from about 18 through around 30. And he did like a 3 or 4 movies about him falling, this kid who was the symbol of Truffaut. I mean, it was really Truffaut, but he had a young actor playing him. And he did about 4 movies of this kid, really a great actor, who grew up through various love, trysts in life and marriages and stuff. I was really into that. And let me see, you know, I haven't watched any French New Wave in maybe 10 years. I mean, really a long time. So I've forgotten the other directors, but all of them. There was like about five or six. And they were really changing how America made movies. Again, it was just a piece of information, a trivia information. I didn't think it would, had anything to do with me or that I would ever be in movies. I never thought about movies. I never thought about being an actor. All I thought was maybe I'd be a funny guy somehow. But I didn't want to do anything. I've never wanted. I still don't want to do anything. I just, you know, I mean, whatever comes to my mind, that's what I do. And then I get, you know, really bent out of shape if somebody, you know, tries to take me away from what I'm doing now. You know, I thought you were into movies. Well, no, but I'm into T-shirts now. So, okay. Like, yeah, that's my painting. See that? That's my paintings. And that's my paintings. Oh. You know? And when I was making film shorts, I have 44 more that can be made into T-shirts. And then when I got into, you know, I was, oh, well, let me see. I'd like to do film shorts now. So I got a nomination for an Academy Award. That's that thing right there. And then I lost interest in that, and I became a stand-up comedian, then I became an actor. I don't know. You know, it's ADHD and then dyslexia. I'm a dyslexic, too, so. Which means I interpret a lot of things people say or try to teach me. It's very hard for me to learn shit linearly. I learn eidetically, you know, like animals learn. You know, like a cheetah doesn't talk to her little cubs and say, you bite them on the neck, first bite their back leg. Yeah, she doesn't do that. She just says, watch. You'll get it after a while. So I have to, like improv. When I was doing improv, I didn't pay much attention to the class. But when you... So I get... You know, I get it.
Yeah. We had a little hiccup there or something, but,
that's okay. So I've had it since, you know, I've had all these things since I was a little guy. I was born with ADHD and dyslexic, but when I was a little kid, way before the 60s, there was no such thing as dyslexia or ADHD. I mean, I was just a crazy kid. Basically, I was just a crazy kid.
I can identify with that because I have both those as well, and
good for you.
Yeah, they put me on medication and in like special learning classes. Was there any? There wasn't right. Anything like that for you in school?
No, because I would love to have been put. I mean, you would have to force me because I didn't like learning because of the difficulty. So I if anybody said you got to learn this or go to this class, I knew it was danger to me, you know. So, but now I wish somebody would have done that, you know, because I know I need it. So I've been doing it to myself. So now I can cope, you know, coping mechanisms and stuff like that.
Right. Well, I see you graduated from Syracuse University. With that in mind, how was your college experience?
Well, most of my life, you could ask that question about, how was your experience about life, Larry? And it comes out the same. There's highs and lows. If you have dyslexia and ADHD, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Sometimes ADHD is your best friend, man, you know, and dyslexia is okay once I put it together, because basically I think how dyslexia and or ADHD work is your mind is going much faster than your metabolism or your grokking ability. Your mind is learning faster than you are. And it just, that's ADHD. It just, and dyslexia misinterprets. So the crashing of those two is just very difficult. So you have to go to, you know, you have to learn about it. But because my subconscious, I guess I'll say it's my subconscious, is just absorbing so much information so fast, and I can't, I can't formulate it. I can't process it fast enough consciously. But when I do, once I do, like if I sleep on something, like if we were discussing a plan or a project, and we were talking about not now, and I was giving you all these answers, and you give me all the answers, that's fine, we're normal, and everything's cool. Tomorrow, after I slept on it, I would have a whole different idea of what we were talking about, a conclusion. So in other words, I would then, tomorrow, call you up and say, hey, man, this is really how it should work from my point of view, and then you could deal with that. So my mind changes vastly over time about one thing as my mind finally puts it together. Like a little cheetah cub learning how to capture, you know, a gazelle or a whatever. You know, they finally get, oh, I get it. You bite it on the back leg and then you go for the underneath the throat, not the back. Okay, cool. I get it. Finally.
Right.
That's how my mind works. And that's how, so now I have to say, I'll think about this and let me call you tomorrow.
Yeah.
So when I do Zoom, that's what I, if I, you know, I'm working on a project with somebody, they now know. I need 24 hours.
Right. I saw you did some work with the Second City Improv. Did you enjoy your time there?
Excuse me? Did I spend a lot of time there?
Or did you enjoy it, doing the improv?
Well, yeah, because, see, they allowed me, again, I studied with Viola Spolin, who was like the Lee Strasberg of improv. I mean, she was a genius. She invented American improvisation, what Second City became. She invented that. She didn't invent it. She discovered it by working with children. She saw that the play that children do in learning, sharing and stuff like that, could be put into a schooling method. She developed a method for teaching children how to improv little playlists, you know, just for fun, as a teaching, kindergarten and above. And she formulated it, taught it to her son, Paul Sills, who then opened Second City based on their teaching. And she taught the classes for the stage show, and he directed the stage show. So if you were going to be in the stage show, I got the audition, and I was put into the company immediately with the proviso that I go to Viola's classes. Now, I was with, in the class was, you know, one of the greats of improv was Del Close. I was in the class with him, and we both hated her, and we hated the class, and we hated her teaching, and we just spoke about it, and we cursed her, and, you know, today I think she's a genius, but I fought everything she tried to teach me. But when I got on the stage, I started to see, you know, I was there for about 6 or 7 months. I started to, holy cow, what she was teaching us, it works, holy cow. But I didn't realize until I was on the stage in the middle of it, and as I got better and better, I got more and more scenes, and then you learn more and more, and I started to say, wow, man, that. And then I went back to the book. She was writing a book while she was teaching us, and she would read the galley proofs to us after class. If anybody wanted to stay, I have some galley proofs for the book about what I'm teaching. And I had to deal with it. You know, I had to come around to realizing I had a learning difficulty, and I had to cope with it.
Right. You know? Now, you said you did the classes for the improv. Do you have to have some natural talent to do it, or do you think anyone can just learn?
Well, yes. Because when I graduated high school, I went to college. I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to go to school. I was a firebug. I was an arsonist. I was setting fires. I mean, that's how fucked up I was. I was getting into all kinds of trouble with the police when I was in high school. I was getting into fights and beat up, and it's crazy. And fun. finally, so I went to Syracuse University because I wanted to be a good kid. I mean, that was the difficulty. I wanted to listen to my parents. I didn't want to listen to what they were telling me. I just wanted to be a good boy. I wanted them to say to me, "Hey, Larry, you're really great. You're a great kid." And all I was getting was parenting. And they were not, my mother was a great parent, but my father was just an idiot. I mean, I never respected him at all. So I didn't believe anything he said. To this day, I don't believe anything he told me. I was right about that. I went to Syracuse and I studied industrial design because it's drawing. See, I like to draw, so, you know, industrial design, that's what I thought it was, drawing. I wanted to go to art school, but she said, no, you have to go to college. So the nearest thing to college art school was industrial design, so I went to that. So I graduated as an A student, but I fought all the way. I was thrown out of college twice for, you know, sassing the teachers, the professors. But I was the head of my class. I thought, I can do what I want, you know. I mean, in marks, you know, design. But once I graduated, my best friend in college was Carl Gottlieb. He wrote Jaws, eventually. We didn't know that at the time, but he wrote Jaws. So he's kind of a smart guy, is why I'm telling you that.
Oh, yeah.
And we hung out together, and then he said, and the reason I liked him was because he had focus, which I didn't have. That was part of when he did write Jaws. I thought, well, yeah, that follows. I mean, that's obvious. So we graduated together, and then he said, where are you going? And I didn't want to go to Detroit to design cars. That's where the industrial design department headed me towards, because I was an A student. See, they want Syracuse, well, any school, A student, they want to place you somewhere so they know, ooh, Syracuse University is designing cars in Detroit because they have students there. You know, they want all their students to get high-paying jobs and stuff. So Carl said, look, instead of going to Detroit and doing that, why don't we go to Greenwich Village and just hang out, you know, and he'll get a job. He wanted to get a job reviewing news, you know, movies for local newspapers, like not even the Village Voice, smaller than that, just local neighborhood newspapers. Which he was doing, because he was focused. And I went to Greenwich Village with him, but I just, I was a swabby in the bar from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. I mean, after closing time. I don't want to see another peanut shell as long as I live. So I would just, you know, swab the duck boards behind the bar and clean up and sweep up. And then at 6 a.m., they would lock me in because it was a bar and grill. And then the chef at 6 a.m. would open the door from the outside. He'd let me out. But I was not making enough money to pay the rent even. I was sharing the rent with Carl. I had no food money left after that. So I was stealing food from the cupboard of the stockpile of the restaurant, the grill part of the bar and grill. And so I got this from, you've seen some Marx Brothers movies, right?
Yes.
Marx Brothers. So I got this idea from Harpo Marx. He was always wearing a raincoat. And if you remember, he was always having spoons and knives dropping out from all the stuff he stole. He was always stealing shit. He's my favorite Marx Brother. And so I wore a raincoat to work in the bar every night. I would get there about 1:30, just before last call. All I, you know, I'd hang out, you know, hang my, you know, get my stuff together, talk to the bartender for a while, and then the police would close. They'd lock me in, and I would do my stuff. And at 5:30, I would go into the storeroom, and I would start loading my pockets of my raincoat. You know, the two side pockets, there was one inside pocket. And then I got to stealing. I worked there for only 3 weeks. I'll tell you why, but I worked there for three. So after the first week, I was just stealing canned goods, which is not good to steal. They're bulky. And I would always stand by the door when the chef opened the door to let me in, to let me out, for him to come in. I would stand right by the door and I wouldn't talk to him. I would just, you know, hi, Carl, how you doing? and I would sidle out. It's like,
right.
I didn't want to stop and talk to me. See, bulges, man. So I just put, you know, okay. And then I started to steal. I was stealing. But I mean, I was starving. It was food, man. It wasn't like I was selling it. I was going home and eating it.
Yeah, you're doing what you needed to survive.
Yes, in my mind, there was a difference. Very little difference. I understood that. But there was a smidgen of difference. So anyway, then, you know, I discovered as I'm going through the cupboard, getting stuff that's not so funky, you know. I find a rasher of bacon. You know, a rasher of bacon is about like that and about that wide, you know. So, that fits in the back of my belt. I would stuff it down the back of my belt and talk it with my and it was flat. And I could face him and say, you know, two or three words to him. And then I was stuffing anything else that was flat into my belt. But after 3 weeks, I quit because I thought they were going to start to take accounting, and there's starting to be holes in the storage of stuff, of particular stuff, you know. So I quit. So now I'm jobless. And Carl started stealing food for me.
Oh, really?
And but he wasn't stealing. Because what he was doing was he was going to review movies for these newspapers.
Yeah.
And before you go, and he was reviewing it with all the big, you know, with New York Times and with the Village Voice and all those, you know, and the Post. He was reviewing movies with all the big reviewers, but he was just local paper. They just had everybody come in, and what they do is they serve you a little wine, the reviewers, some wine. And some, you know, the cold shrimp in bowls, you know, in the iced bowls, cold shrimp. So they feed you and get you a little high, and then you go into do the movies. So Carl, he would be in reviewing movies pretty much at least 3 to 4 days a week, all day, you know, just 2 to 3 movies a day. So he would take a big, huge handful of this cold shrimp. And they had damask napkins. In those days, they had real linen napkins. No paper napkin. Real. And he would take a napkin, put the shrimp in a napkin, wrap it up, and he would put it in his suit pocket. And then he would bring it home to me. And that was my dinner. I just had to get through breakfast and lunch. Well, I fuck lunch. Just breakfast, and I would wait for Carl. And then he would bring it home. And then that. He did that for about a month, and then his suit started to smell of fish. So we had to quit. But I saved all the napkins. I would hang them all over the place. There's about 30 of them. That's a lot of not of napkins. So anyway, I started to hang around because I had a lot of time on my hands. Monday open mic nights. And I was a funny guy in high school. I graduated in high school. I won funniest in high school 2 years in a row in Far Rockaway High School. So I was a funny guy, and I knew I was kind of funny, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought, I was watching these comedians and folk singers, you know, I was just hanging out, you know, for you know, $1, $2, a cup of coffee, and you spend the whole evening there. So I was watching these comedians, you know, get up, you know, they do 3 to 5 minutes. I thought, man, I'm funnier than these guys. These guys are not funny. Or these women. I'm not funny at all.
Is that?
So I got up on the stage, you know, 3 to 5 minutes. I just talked. You know, I didn't write anything down. I just got up there and started to talk. Nothing. Not funny at all. There's a difference between telling high school friends funny stuff and getting elected. And getting on a stage in front of people who don't know who the fuck you are or where you came from and why you're talking about what you are. So they would just sit there, you know, which is a great thing. Later on, when I was getting paid a lot of money and people didn't like it, they would boo me or tell me to get off the stage or, you know, heckle. But when Monday night, open mic nights, they knew that what they were in for. They would just there to, you know, maybe one funny guy. But they knew that everybody's not going to be, you know, Richie Pryor, you know, so they just, they would sit there like this. I loved it. If you're not funny, they would just.
Sit there and stare at you.
And that's cool, man, because, you know, that's okay. And then if you said something funny, they would laugh. But in other words, they understood. Well, this one isn't funny. I'll wait for the next guy. They didn't mind, and that helped me a lot. The learning thing. In other words, I wasn't being totally fucking rejected every time. With, you know, hey, get off this. You know, none of that. So I wasn't funny at all. I have recordings of me that. I don't know what the hell I was doing, but I thought it was funny at the time. You know, oh, you know, there's this mosquito in the room, so I was a psychiatrist and I got him to lay down on the couch, and then I took the couch and I slammed it against the ceiling, and that killed the mosquito. I mean, come on, man. Silly, but come on. So, but after 6 months, I got a manager and I was opening for Woody Allen. So my learning curve is cool, and that. So then I said, oh, I see what it is. And I started to understand about the learning, you know, okay, that's what that is. All right, fine. But I still have the sense inside that I'm funny. So then I was opening for Woody. I had Woody Allen's manager. And I was opening for Miles Davis and the Kingston Trio. Arena concerts for the rock and roll crowd. But I started because I'm a learner. See, that's the yin of the yang. You know, it's a good thing to I like ADHD and dyslexia, but the bad thing, I just like to learn. So, as I was opening for Woody Allen, I started to leave Woody, and I started to get into Richie Pryor, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, and that. You know, Woody is not that Woody's audience is not that audience. Kingston Trio is not Lenny Bruce's audience. So all of a sudden, cops are starting to show up, and people are coming at me with beer bottles, man. I was starting to get the Lenny Bruce treatment. And Richie Pryor got that treatment, too. He just didn't talk about it. Well, yeah. You know, that's why he burned his face off. I mean, you know. So I called my manager. I said, look, man, you know, I'm not Lenny Bruce, and I'm not even into drugs yet. Yeah, that was down the road. But, you know, so I really took umbrage. I mean, look, I got a learning disability. I understand. And I'm cursing on stage. I understand, you know, and I'm talking about body parts. I understand. But I'm not into drugs. So why are you taking me off the stage? In other words, they narrowed it down to that, you know. Oh, it's not my cursing. Or am I saying, you know, tits, ass, you know, whatever.
Right.
It was, I thought it was because they thought I was doing drugs. And I was. So I called them and I said, hey, man, I'm a middle-class Jewish kid. And I have cops taking me off the stage in the middle of a concert, in the middle of a 11 Spoonful concert at Washington University in St. Louis, which I thought was a rock and roll crowd. You can, you know, 60s. No, man. You know, they were still busting Carlin and Pryor for doing that. We're telling them to take it. So he said, my manager, Woody's manager, the great Jack Rollins, he said, join Second City. They're doing the same thing as Lenny and Richie are doing, but they own the theater. And if somebody comes in at you with a beer bottle, which they did, an upside down beer bottle, get the fuck off the stage, man. Yeah, okay, I'm off. No sweat, no argument here. I'm just having fun. So I joined Second City, you know, Boyola Spolin, et cetera. And I was good at that. I was great at that. And that, besides stand-up, improvisation is a sweet spot for me. For ADHD and dyslexia, perfect. You're on stage with other people, so there's a give and take, but it's all from your own head. It's instant. You don't have to remember anything. The interesting thing was I can't memorize lines. I mean, I can memorize lines as an actor. I just got a part. fucking co-star. A co-star lead. Now, today. I just got it yesterday morning.
No, oh, congratulations.
That, well, no. Okay, so here's the... That's the yin. Here's the yang. The part is a CIA... it's kind of a sci-fi thing. And he's the CIA... you know, rocket kind of guy, you know, ICBM type of guy, that kind of general for Secret Service. So the entire part is just a lot of engineering and scientific verbiage. You know, long speeches that, you know, that long, you know, as he's explaining, you know, this and that and charts. I can't do it. I mean, it would take, I can do it, but it would take me a year of memorizing that role. So I have to turn it down. I mean, it's not an interesting role. It's not funny. It's a serious role. You know, it's a serious sci-fi aliens are coming or the Russians are coming. Or the Australians are coming, or, you know, somebody's coming. And we got to, you know. So I have to turn it down, which makes me sad. I don't particularly think the role is great for me, for my particular talents. But because of ADHD and the dyslexia, I have to turn it down, not because of the role, but because of my inability to just memorize that much information overnight, you know, for the next day's shooting. You have to, you know, you just learn the next day. You learn the next day. You learn. And there's no way. I mean, so I've written my own movie. And I've written a part for me that's a nice part. It's a great part. But I can memorize it. It's, you know, and that's the other thing I discovered, which is really weird. How you know, you two halves of your brain. I can memorize my own writing way faster than I can anybody else's writing. Even Vince Gilligan's writing, who's a great writer, and his writing, you know, Breaking Bad, is much easier for me to memorize than anybody else's writing. I mean, good writing, you know. I can memorize Mark Twain's paragraphs from Huck Finn easier than I can memorize this screenplay that I just got.
Yeah.
Good writing is easy, easier, not easy, easier. So that's what I do. So I write my little, and I'm trying to do a one-man show. No, I'm trying to do. I'm gathering, doing research for a one-man show. And that's fun because I like the stage, and improv is the best. You don't have to memorize anything. You just go up there. And if you are in any way observant about human nature, you know, you're a good improviser. You're ready. You know, you just have to learn the basics. You know, don't interrupt, don't talk over, don't plot. That's the worst thing you can do. Is you have a joke in mind that you're going for? Whoa, in the toilet, because the other person doesn't know where you're going. He only knows where you both are, you know?
Right.
So you deal with the now, always with the now. But if you see a direction, you know, don't stop it. Just go with the flow. But if I have something in mind, you know, 40 or 45 seconds from now, it's death because you don't know where the hell I'm going.
True.
You can't improvise. You just have to stop and let me go, and the scene just caves in. There's no relationship, you know. So if you once you learn that, I mean, that's easy. That's you know, that's all that stuff that Dell and I were arguing about. Say, we don't need shit, you know. But it works. So so I can memorize my stuff easier than anybody else's, and good writing is easier. But this isn't good, you know. And scientific and mathematical and all that. I can't do that.
No. Well, let's get into your acting career a little bit. You're in the classic Escape from Alcatraz. How did
Yeah.
How did that come about, getting that role? And what was it like working with Clint Eastwood back then?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a common question, but it's in the wrong direction. That's really interesting. When you talk about Alcatraz, anybody, to me, when people ask me a question, they say, what was it like working on Alcatraz, and what was it like working for Clint Eastwood? And that's not where I went at all. I was working with the director, Don Siegel.
Ah.
That's the guy, and nobody knows about that. But Don Siegel taught Clint Eastwood everything he knows about directing. He was teaching Clint Eastwood how to direct. Clint Eastwood is a great director nowadays. He's a great actor, no sweat. But Don Siegel was way more interesting than Clint Eastwood. And so I just followed Don Siegel around like that. It was great working on the movie. It was great working with Clint Eastwood. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. He's totally real. You know, all that shit you see in, you know, Hollywood Magazine and with the Republican thing that he did with the chair.
Yeah.
Now, that's stupid. That's, you know, just him trying to be a politician. I think he was elected mayor of Malibu or something like that. Further down. But anyway, so he was doing, he had an agenda. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
But on the set, he was Clint Eastwood as a regular guy. He would hang out with me a little, but he loved hanging out with the extras, the 200 prisoners who were extras who acted as prisoners. He would eat lunch with them. He would talk to them. He would joke around with them. He was one of them. I mean, he didn't hang around with the star actor who played the what do you call it? The guy who ran the prison.
The warden.
Who?
The warden.
The warden. The warden. That guy was drunk the whole time. He was just drunk the whole time. It was never sober. I never saw the man sober. I was on that movie 3 months. Never saw him sober.
Oh,
he
wow.
never came out on the set. Always in his dressing room. He only came out. He had a knock on the door. You're up, you know, you're on. And he would come out maybe 30 seconds before the movie, before he's, you know, he had to get in front of the camera. He just always knew his lines, totally professional. Never screwed up. Never said a wrong word. Never spoke to anybody. Totally blotto all the time. Just standing there, eyes totally red, reeking alcohol. I asked Clint. They said I call him Clint now. You know, he's my buddy.
First name basis.
Yeah. So I asked Clint. They said, "Do you know that warden's name? I don't know. I keep on forgetting. He's a famous guy. He's a really good actor. He never screwed up. I mean, he was right on." I said, "Do you ever talk to him? Because he never talked to him." And Clint smiled. He said, no, he stays in his dressing room. He never mentioned, Clint never mentioned, nobody ever mentioned that he was a drinker, that he was drunk all the time. Hey, as long as you know your lines, you hit your mark, you know, and don't throw up on any of the other actors, you're cool, you know, you're fine.
Yeah.
He never did any of those things. So he's fine. So, I mean, even the Don Siegel, I would ask him, I'd say, you know, did you ever talk to him? Because, no. But they wouldn't, that's all they would say. And then they would change the subject. They didn't want to talk about it. But they were very kind, very sociable to him. You know, how you doing? You know, stand over there. You know, you want to rehearse? They would rehearse. And then, say, you know, and then, okay, cut. Thank you. Moving on. He'd go back into the dressing room and stay there. Never came out until his next scene.
Oh, wow.
So that was the interesting part. Being on Alcatraz, of course, was a trip. And, you know, Clint Eastwood, he gets a little feisty now and then, but I have an attitude problem. I guess it's because of my learning disability and my not getting along with my father. The combination just gives me an attitude, you know, and I don't like people in my face. The thing is, I'm triggered. I'm dealing with it now in my golden years. I'm dealing with being triggered. My attitude is, I'm getting mellow. bullshit, Nello. But, you know, I'm dealing with it. But back in the day, you know, so nobody, and Clint, you know, he doesn't take any crap either. So it was very interesting. Because, hey, he's my senior, and B is I was in awe of him. So one day we're doing this scene, and I noticed this pattern that would happen. Most of my scenes were with Clint, or at least I was in the scene somewhere with Clint. So I was always with him somewhere.
Right.
I was having a scene with him. And the ritual, and I never left the set, never. In 3 months, I was always standing next to Don Siegel. I was just there, man. I was not that I was an actor. I was with Don Siegel and Clint Eastwood, and I wouldn't go anywhere else. There was no other place more interesting than those two guys, to me, personally. So, and as an actor who I wanted to learn how to act. And so I noticed that every time I did a scene, Don Siegel would say, cut. He would come over, he'd walk over to Clint. I was standing right next to him. He'd walk over to Clint, and he'd say, how was that for you, Clint? Every time. And Clint would say one of three things, either that's okay. And he'd say, all right, moving on. Boom. Or he would say, it was okay for me. How was it for you? And then Don Siegel would say, it was fine for me. Moving on. Or he would say, we had a little trouble with the camera. We got to do it again. It wasn't you. Don't worry about it. You know, and then he would say, oh, okay. But Clint wanted always to know the reason. He'd say, why are we doing this again? He only wanted to do one take.
Mm.
Through the 3 months. If there was a second take, he would always say, why are we doing this again? And then Don Siegel would have to answer, you know, and it would always say, well, there was a technical difficulty. It was the answer. And they would be very fine. But if Don Siegel didn't give him a good answer, he'd say, no. And then Don would have to say, well, look, please, you know. And then we'd go, okay. So one time I heard Clint Eastwood say, how's that for you, Clint? And Clint said, I'd like to do it again. I think I could do it better. Okay, fine, we'll do it again. Okay, we're going to set up again and do it again. Okay, fine, we do it again. Okay, how's that for you? Fine. Okay, another scene I'm in with Clint. How was that for you, Clint? Yeah, that was fine for me. And I piped up because I was getting, like, nervous. They never talked to me. He never even looked at me. Ever. Neither one of them. They would just talk right in front of my fucking face. And they were just talking like, is that okay for you? Yeah, that's okay for me. Can I do it again? Yeah, let's do it again. Well, there's a technical difficulty. So this time when he said, you know, I said, okay, fine. And next time he goes, I said, I piped up. I said, well, it was okay for me. And he was about to say, okay, moving on. I said, no, I'd like to do it again. I can do it better. And Clint just looked at me and said, yeah, well, I can't. And he walked away.
Oh, jeez.
Whoa, and that was it. I mean, and no words, and then they just, like I never happened. Mm. Just, yeah, moving on. Like, well, I really got insulted, man.
Right.
By Clint. I said, I got to get him back, man. Because the crew laughed at that. When he walked away, I could hear him. I heard it. So for days, I would be up at night. I'm in the barrel now. It was his crew. It was Clint's crew. They did everything with him. All his movies, the same guys. So I thought, I can take a little of this shit from Clint, but I'm not going to take any of the crap from the crew and Clint. So I got to get back at Clint to show them. And that was all I was thinking. And so one day, I was waiting, and finally it happened. He comes after me. How's that for you, Clint? And Clint, unfortunately, we were on C tier in front of actually, I think it was my cell. It didn't matter whose cell it was. We were on C tier, but not shooting down the tier. You know, the tier goes this way, and then you fall off that way, right?
Right.
So the tier is this way. They were shooting this way. So the camera was hanging out back over the railing, you know, shooting into the cell. And what Don Siegel wanted to do is he wanted to shoot Clint and the warden talking like this. And I was standing, somehow I was standing next to him, just listening. He goes, blah, 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 cut. Clint, how is that for you? And Clint said, and I was in the scene. I just wasn't talking.
Right.
And Clint says, I'd like to do it again. I can do it better. And I just said, well, I can't. And I just walked away. Unfortunately for me, yeah, ha, 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 ha. Unfortunately, we were on the tier. So the only way I could walk away was down this way. I couldn't even walk that way. I mean, there's a camera and the two guys were in the way. So I had to walk away that way. And the door was about a mile down that way. And I just had to keep walking alone, keeping up this stupid umbrage. I'm not turning back. I don't care if I get fired. I'm not turning around. I don't have to take this crap from anybody. And the door is getting further and further away. I could just see. And finally, just as I got to the door, and it was a long time, finally, I just, Clint says, hey, Larry, come on back, man. Right, hey, it's okay. Come here. Where are you going? And he was laughing, man. He was fucking laughing. He thought it was very funny. So, you know, but... So that's what it was like on the set, you know. It was just me and you know, me and my learning disabilities and my umbrage and my chip on my shoulder. But it was a great movie and I did a good job. You know, Clint really liked what I did and that was very important to me. And Don Siegel liked what I was doing. And he would, that was the other thing, both of them. Don Siegel is way back. He comes from the black and white movies, you know, directing Lee Marvin and all the big black and white movie stars, you know. And they used to put each other on all the time. So to them, and even Clint Eastwood, even though he was a next generation, but he was into that kind of fooling around on the set, you know, if it was a close-up or it was a choker, you took your pants off because of the hot lights, so you're acting in your underwear because the camera was only, you know, this high. You know, they were doing a... So, and Don was part of that too. So one time, what did he do? He said, I was trying to explain to him, in the last scene of mine, the scene before the, when they make the break and I can't go with them because I can't get out or I'm afraid to get out. And when the, and I start to cry, you know, I because, he comes up to us playing cards with the crew. Cause I wasn't up for a long time. And once you are out on Alcatraz Island, you got to stay there the whole day. Even if you're the first shot in the morning, there's only two fleets of boats because there's 200 guys on a, you know, the 7 and 8 o'clock fleet and the 7 and 9 o'clock fleet back. So if you're on there, you're there for the whole day.
Right.
So he goes, Larry, and this is in the morning. My shot is right before lunch. This is early in the morning. I'm playing cards. And he goes, what are you doing, Larry? I'm playing cards with the guys. Why? I'm not up for another 2 or 3 hours. He says, you know, you're going to cry today, right? No, I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah, this is a scene where you're in the cell and you're, you know, they're escaping and you can't get out and you're all bent out of shape. So you're crying. I need you to cry, right? Oh, okay. And, you know, all of a sudden the card game is stopped, you know, while he's talking to me. I go, he says, you can cry, right? Well, and he saw my hesitation. He goes, look, Larry, I need you to cry in 2 hours. Now, can you cry or not? I said, well, I don't know. Because I didn't, He goes, look, I need you to cry, so I don't know what you're doing here, but you got to get into your dressing room and you got to start crying. I don't care if you have to slap yourself silly, but 2 hours, you got to cry. Okay. And then he just walks away. So I say to the guys, okay, I got to, you know, I'm out. I got to go cry. You know, I go to my dressing room and I'm literally, because I'm not an actor, I'm a stand-up comedian. You know, I'm pretending. I'm faking it, the whole thing. So, I mean, that's in my mind. That's what I am. So I go into my dressing room. Nothing. So I'm trying to figure out how to make myself cry. I'm pinching my nose. I'm punching myself. Nothing, man. So finally, I just give up. I say, well, I'm going to be fired. You know, that's my go-to. That's my go-to protection. I'm going to be fired. Fuck it. Next, I'm on to the next job already. So I break and I go out and I say, where's Don Siegel? I got to talk to him. This is important. So I go, Don, can I talk to you for a second? Yeah, what? Look, I'm sorry, man, but I don't think my character would cry in this situation. Really? Oh, well, why is that, Larry? Well, because, I mean, seeing the situation, I mean, I have a backstory, and this would, it's not part of my character, and seeing this situation, see, he's not the kind of person who would break down in this situation. And then Don Siegel turns to his girl Friday, Carol. It's about a woman of about 28. Carol, would you come over here for a second? Okay. And she's got all those notebooks and stuff in his secretary. Go ahead. Larry is my secretary. Carol, would you tell Carol what you just told me? Now, she doesn't know what's going on, and now neither do I. I don't know why I'm going to tell her. So she goes, okay, what is it? I say, well, you know, I don't have my backstory and blah, 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 and he wouldn't cry and blah, 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 blah. So then Don Siegel turns to her and he says, now, Carol, do you know what the fuck he's talking about? I need a guy to cry in about a half hour. I got a movie that's, he goes like this. I got a movie here. I got a movie here. And it's all guys. It's all testosterone. They're all in jail, you know. And he's on Alcatraz. He's pointing to the ceiling. And they're all in jail. And there's all this testosterone. I need somebody to cry right about here. And then he turns to me and he says, Larry, do you know whose scene is right here? Your scene in a half hour, right there. I need somebody to cry. I need something to get rid of all this testosterone and this anger. So you're crying. Now, either you slap yourself silly, but you're going to cry. And he walks away. So now I'm like, holy cow, man, this is serious. But I don't know what to do, so I went back to my, you know, go-to. I'm going to be fired. If he needs it that bad, and I can't do it, I'm going to be fired. He gets in the scene, and he goes, but I'm not saying anything. I show up on a set. He says, you ready, Larry? Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to be fired. That's what I meant.
Right.
And I'm ready, yeah, I'm ready. Get in the cell, okay. And then he puts the camera, and you look at it. This is a scene. It's in the movie. You look at it. The camera is this. It's just my face. The camera is that far away from my face. No, not that far away. Not that far away. He says, are you ready? I go, yeah. It's okay. And action. I go, it's nothing's happening. He goes, okay, cut. And I go, okay. And I'm thinking, you're fired. He goes, Harry, bring it in. Harry comes in. Harry is one of the crew, and he's got a perfume bottle, you know, with the squeezer on it.
Yeah.
The old-fashioned squeezer.
Yeah.
With liquid in it. And he goes, Harry, give it to him. Harry comes up to me right by my side of my face this way. And he goes, choo, 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 with whatever's in that bottle. tears. Crying like crazy, man. He goes, roll it, roll it, roll it. The camera's just rolling. He's, yeah, yeah, Larry. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's good. That's good. cut. Larry, that was great. Thank you very much. Moving on. What was that all about? He says, that was Winter Makes You Cry. And he walks away. He knew that from the card game on. He knew that. He was just putting me on for 2 hours, making me go crazy with being, you know. So that's also what was going on. And that just happened, you know, mainly every other day there was something like that, you know. But it was fun, and it's a great movie, and I watch it and I go, you know, I'm not bad in that. That's for all the bullshit that was behind the camera, you don't see any of that. The warden is great. I think the drunk stuff, that pasty face that he has, just helped him. Maybe that was what he was doing, is just staying drunk just to be a good warden.
Could have been.
The dead eyes and shit. Yeah, I mean, it worked. You cannot tell that he's drunk. He's the warden, man. He's a badass. You know?
Right.
He likes to have clean nails. I guess that's the takeaway from the movie. Clean nails. Okay. Yeah, that's that story.
We'll jump forward a little bit. You had cameos in 3 John Hughes films, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, She's Having a Baby, and the greatest Christmas film ever made, in my opinion, Home Alone. That's my favorite. Did you develop a friendship with Mr. Hughes, or how did it come to be that you appeared in some of his films?
Well, he just liked my character. He liked what I did with his writing. That's all. I mean, when it comes to those kind of decisions, all directors are the same, but the great ones totally the same. No, if they don't believe you can give them what they need, I'm not talking about what they want, but what they need. If you can't give them what they need, they have no compunction to get rid of you right on the spot. I mean, there's no love lost or feelings of, you know, regret or being sorry. Or, hey, I'm sorry, I gotta fire you. No, you're just not doing the job. Goodbye. And there's no anger involved. There's no. John Hughes is one of those kind of guys. He fired somebody, John Hughes, on She's Having a Baby. I remember, you know, it wasn't John Huston, but he fired somebody named John Huston.
Yeah.
So when I came on the set, it was an AD. Because when I came on the set, I said, hey, where's John? And he goes, oh, John Hughes fired him. Yeah, yesterday at night, you know, right before he went home. He's fired. He's not coming back. What for? I don't know. No, nobody said. He was just told to leave. He just got up and left. So, I mean, you're out of nowhere, you know, boom. And then the audition for Escape from Alcatraz, I was hired, I figured out, because somebody was just fired. Because my agent just called me and said, hey, get down to Warner Brothers. What are you doing right now? I said, I'm watching television. Get down to Warner Brothers right now. They're casting for Clint Eastwood's next big movie, and they want you down there within an hour. And it takes about 45 minutes to get out to the valley from where I was living. So I had to really step on it.
Yeah.
So there's no sides or anything. I mean, you know, I had to just leave the house and go, I said, you know, where's the sides? What's the part? I don't know what I'm doing. They'll give you all the information when you get there, but get down there right away. So that was my hint. I'd been acting long enough to know that under those circumstances, somebody just got fired and they have to replace you immediately by tomorrow morning. You know, that's what's going on. So I had an attitude, you know, why didn't they hire me in the first place? Well, you're hiring me to replace somebody. I'm good enough to replace them. I'm not good enough to hire in the first place. Screw you. That's how I'm driving to the valley. And it's just getting worse and worse as I'm getting there. So finally I get there and I walk in. There's nobody there. So I knew, okay, that's exactly what happened. Because there's no other actors there. The room is empty. I'm there. There's just a secretary. So I go up to the secretary. I say, hey, you know, the Alcatraz thing, I'm auditioning. I don't know what for. Is there any sides? I don't know what's going on. They told me I'd have the information. There's no information. She says, well, I have a script. Well, you know, but I don't know what page. I don't know even if you, I told me the character, I don't know what page. You told me the page, I don't know what, okay, give me. So I take it and I go, hey. So I just put it in my lap. I mean, I can't read a whole thing. And then right as I put it in my lap, door opens. Are you ready, Larry? Yeah, I'm ready. By now, I don't even want to be in this movie. I mean, it's just not going right, you know? It's not. I mean, yeah, I'm ready. I sit down, and there's Don Siegel. Clint Eastwood was supposed to be there. I was also nervous, so that's getting me frustrated. He's not even there. So it's really not turning out right. There's just this woman and Don Siegel. And I don't know who Don Siegel is yet. Not until I left and asked a friend, who is Don Siegel? He's the guy who directed up. Holy shit. Well, I just, okay. So I don't even know who he is, so I don't even respect him.
Right.
He's a guy with white hair. And I sit down, and he goes, how you doing, Larry? I go, hi. I don't know who this woman is. She's about 50, I guess. He's about 60. I'm sitting in a chair. There's just three chairs facing each other in an empty room. And he goes, well, what part do you want to do? I go, I don't know. I don't even know what's going on. I don't know who I am. I don't know anything. What's going on? And he goes, oh, okay. And then he just turns to her and he goes, oh, what do you think he could do? And they're talking about me. Well, I don't know. Well, let's see. What about the warden? You think you could do the warden? Oh, I don't know if he could do the warden. Yeah, I don't think he could do the warden either. Larry, can you do the warden? I don't know. What is the warden? Well, I don't think you can do the warden. You have to beat Clint Eastwood up. Can you? Do you think you can beat Clint Eastwood up? I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so either. I don't think so. No. So no warden. No. Who else we got? Well, we got Charlie Butts. Charlie Butts. You want to do Charlie Butts, Larry? I don't know. What's Charlie Butts like? Well, and she says, no, wait a minute. And she takes the script and she points to something and she says, it's written right here. Charlie Butts is short, fat, he's got freckles, he's bald, and he's wearing glasses. And Don Siegel reads it and he goes, audience doesn't have the screenplay. You want to do Charlie Butts? Okay. All right. You want to read with me? I'll read with you right now. And then you got the script. You want to rehearse it? You want to go outside? No, let's, I mean, I'm out of there. No, I don't want to do it. No, let's just, I'll just read it cold with you. Okay, fine. Turn to page 96. Okay, you're Charlie Butts. I'll be whoever the other person was, you know. Okay, ready, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, it's just a page, just that one page, that's all. Thank you. Okay. All right. Okay, so you got the part. I just sat there. What? You don't believe me? No, I don't believe you. Okay, tell you what you do, Larry. Go home, sit by the phone, see what happens. Get out of here. Okay. And I left. That's like, yeah. That's the second director that said that to me, who hired me. When I got home, the phone was ringing, and my agent said, hey, man, you got the fucking part, man. Whoa! Now, that's all that's the entire audition. I just did the entire audition. Sorry it took so long, but it was a very short audition, one of the shortest auditions. I didn't know it was Don Siegel. I didn't know anything else about the part except what I told you when I showed up. I was Charlie Butts. I read all these parts. I didn't know until I watched the movie, when I bought a ticket, when I think I saw the crew and the cast and crew screening of the movie, which was months after the movie was finished. When my name came up, it was co-starring Larry Hankin, and I don't even know the name. He's a friend of mine, but I don't know his name. I got co-star billing in that movie. I didn't ask for it. And thinking back to how I went into that audition, that's like a miracle, man.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be there. I didn't believe him when he said, you got the part. I wanted to walk out of the audition. I thought these two people were idiots. By the way, the woman who was with Don Siegel was the head of the casting of major motion pictures. She was the head of either Warner Brothers or I guess it was Warner Brothers. She was a big maha too. I had no idea, man. I go through life kind of like that.
Yeah. Do you think it made you less nervous knowing that? They're not knowing that information?
Oh yeah. I kind of think I got it because of my attitude. That's the only thing I can think of. You know, my daddy says, you know, I was just sitting there, like, looking at him, like, why are you putting me on like this? When he said to me, you don't believe me, do you? That sentence out of his face was based on what he saw of me, in my body language. Yeah, I just like looking at him like, you fuck. I'm here to audition, and you just, you know, playing with me.
Right.
You know? And he goes, you don't believe me, do you? I said, no, I don't. All right. Go home, sit by the phone, see what happens. It's cool. So now there's other times where I really wanted to get the part, and I rehearsed, and they were kind and polite to me, and it was a regular, ordinary audition, and I didn't get the part. Okay. I mean, you know, you deal with that. Okay. And then I would watch the show. I always did this. If I didn't get a part, I would make sure I watched the show to see who did get the part. And I was pissed off every time. They gave the part to that guy and I didn't get the part? What the, man? What? Why am I auditioning then? I mean, look who they're hiring. I mean, that's what I would go through.
Well, you've been in lots of movies or TV shows as well, and as we start to wind down here, you appeared in Breaking Bad and El Camino, which was released on Netflix last year.
How
did you enjoy your experiences with
best time ever? The guys right up there. I mean, because it was Vince Gilligan, you know, from the top down, you know, so everybody was the only time I've ever been on a set with that much people on the same page trying to make the same movie with the same attention to detail and quality was Barry. Barry, the series.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who's the star of that?
I don't remember. I can pull it up.
Barry.
I can pull it up.
That's really weird. Difficult.
Bill Hader.
Bill Hader, right. Bill Hader is going to be a great director someday. He's a great director now, but I mean, he's going to get better. So those two. When Bill Hader is a writer, director, and actor. He's good. I follow him. I'm a very big believer in Bill Hader's talent. He makes me laugh. He's a good writer, good director. But everybody on that set of Barry was making the same movie and the same attention to detail that Bill Hader has, and I respect that. And the same thing with Vince Gilligan. Really top notch. And even when I had difficulty with his lines, and I did, he just got me right back on track, you know. He is like, and all the good ones are, John Huston, when I was in Annie, and I didn't talk to him much, but I really liked Dr. John, because he just was wise. I mean, even if he was talking about bubblegum, it would be the wisest thing anybody ever said about bubblegum. I mean, the guy's just amazing. I said to him, one of the things he said about what we're talking about, he said, you know, okay, 80% of your movie is in the casting. I go, why is that? And he said, because he doesn't direct. Great directors don't direct. they help you get where you want to go. And Al Pacino said that. That Al Pacino said, I use directors as a safety net. I like to take chances, obviously. He likes to take chances. So I like to go way the hell out, and then director kind of pulls me back in or saves me from just falling off the edge. And so John Huston believed in that, and he said, because 80% of your movie is because why would you hire this actor? You hire the actor because of the choices he makes. So if you're going to direct him, tell him what to do, you're defeating the purpose of why you hired him. But what you want to do is help him get to where he wants to go, knowing when you hired him, he's going to go where you want to go. He's going to help you tell your story. So leave him alone, but help him. Like Larry David did that. One day I wanted to do Tom Pepper, Who Stole the Raisins, and I wanted to do Stoneface. Buster Keaton was my image. I said, Tom Pepper is passive aggressive in my mind. So I'm going to do Stoneface and make his anger funnier. That was my plot, my plan, my backstory. And Larry David, one day when I said, you know, the raisins are dried fruit, that scene with Costanza.
Yeah.
He stopped the scene in the middle and he comes up to me. He says, come here, I want to talk to you. I go, oh, cool. A director who wants to talk to me. Cool. You know, all right. He goes, I know what you do. No, he whispers to me, which is kind of nice. You know, you just keep it private. I know what you're trying to do. The word trying was push the hackles up. What do you mean trying? You know, that's what I'm thinking. What do you mean trying? I'm a professional actor. I'm either doing it or I'm not. Try or not try. You know, do or not do. You know, trying, you know. Right. So I gave him a little attitude back because I'm a professional actor. What do you do? Oh, really? What am I trying to do? And he goes, you're trying to do nothing. And I was so amazed. I go, holy cow, that's so amazing. That's great. That's the greatest piece of directing I've ever gotten. I was ready to argue with him, but he just surprised me with the truth, his accuracy. So I go, yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to do. Thank you. And he goes, well, you're doing something. And he walked away. And I thought, I want you to cry. I need you to cry. Okay, that he was putting me on, because it didn't matter whether I could cry or not. That's not why he hired me. He hired me because of the moxie he saw in the audition, and this cold reading that I did. You know, no, let's not. You know, he likes that. He likes that. No, let's just fucking do it, man. Boom. Well, whatever I was giving him in attitude and stuff, he thought, yeah, that's. I like this guy. Whatever. So, yeah, anyway. Vince Gilligan, it was great. The whole thing was, and I learned a lot, man. Again, with Vince, I never left the set. I never left the set. I left his side. I never left what he was doing. He was never out of my sight. And he knew it. He knew it. One day he came up to me, just out of the blue. He came up to me, he said, would you like to see my shot list, my shot book? I go, yeah, that would be great. He goes, they all have their girl Friday. He says, hey, give him my shot book. And it's this big log book. It was a loose leaf notebook about that thick. And I was going through it, and he had every single shot of the movie, El Camino. Every single shot was on a page, just particularly schematically with a ruler. It was with ruler. The picture where the camera was, the angles, the distances, the lens, what the scene was about underneath in a paragraph, who was in pages and pages of notes and stuff. It was just, so he was watching me, you know, at the same time, because he kind of figured I would have liked that.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. Go ahead.
Oh, no, when I went up on my lines, Like one time I was really having a difficult time with the walk around the car. I don't know if you remember that. It doesn't matter. But I had to walk around a car and just walk and talk. It's walk and talk that is very hard because you're not talking to people. You're just, it's a long monologue, basically. But when you talk to some, because of what they said, so it helps you remember your next line. So it's back and forth. But a walk and talk. So he just said, hey, I want to talk to the camera crew. There was three cameras on me, just on me. They were all moving, you know, as I was going around. They were just, you know, going like this and stuff. So I said, why are all these three cameras here? So he said, oh, they're all on you. I go, oh, man. So that already gave me made me nervous. I said, oh, this, I guess this is it's an important thing I'm doing. I didn't realize
it. Yeah.
So I started to walk around, but I was kind of nervous. So I was going very slow, trying to memorize my lines. And he said, no, you got to do it faster. So I did it faster, and I went up on my line. So he just said, I want to talk to the cameraman. Everybody take five. You know, just work on that. Okay. And he went, he got all the cameramen. He went into the TV village. Anyway, they had a big conference in there. I don't know what the fuck. But I just kept on going around until he said, okay, time is up. And he came back and he said, you ready, Larry? And I said, yeah, let's go. And they shot it. And that's what you saw. And he even liked the fact, because we did it like three or four times. The thing was, and the great thing, because he knew about benefits. When he had everybody in the tent, there was a camera operator. Not the cinema. There were the cinematographer and two of the camera operators was in the tent. But one of the camera operators was watching me. He didn't go in the tent. He was watching me rehearse. And he was on the camera. And then he had the camera pushers follow me. So he was rehearsing. And then, and this has never happened. Yeah, this has never happened in any movie. It's verboten. But everybody was in the tent. So this camera operator came up to me. And he said, when you come around to, because this was his shot, when I came in front of his camera. He said, when you come over around here, he said, you're looking at the car, you're examining the car. Just lift your head up a little. Because if you come around and just lift up your head, you know, look around or look wherever, just look up, I can get a real cool shot of you, you know, right at that moment, just as you go around the corner. It looks really cool. So could you do that? And no camera operator or cinematographer would ever talk to an actor like that and tell them, you know, just give him a physical direction, you know, not even a character direction, but, you know, just lift your head so I can get a great shot. That was, but he knew that everybody was in there. And I thought that was really cool, you know, and I wanted to work with him. I'm, you know, I thought, yeah, get a good shot of me. Fine.
Yes.
That's good. And Vince understood that. I think he either saw it or knew what was going on because there's one camera operator missing. But when he came back, you know, I just did it three or four times. And one of the times I tripped, you know, going around. But I kept on doing it. And that was the shot that he picked, the one where I tripped. So I thought, again, when I saw the movie, when I went to see the movie, I thought, that's cool, man. I when I tripped, I thought, shit, man. I mean, not only can't I memorize my lines, but now I tripped. And he's got to shoot it again. But after I tripped, I had done it like three times. And the fourth time I tripped, and then he said, moving on. Because that's the one. I mean.
Makes it a little more real.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So they like these little mistakes or these just realities, little pieces of realities that, you know, and sometimes an actor, like, you're going to need a bigger boat, you know, in that choice.
Yeah.
That was an improv. Hey, let's keep it, man. That's cool. You know, a lot of that stuff happens. And a lot of actors can do that. I can't. If I improv out of a speech, I can't go back to the same place. You know, you kind of drop out, improvise, and go back. I'll come back in somewhere else. And so I don't do that. I don't improv.
Right. And you have also written a book titled The Loopholes Dossier, a Satire, How was the process of writing a book, and what was the inspiration?
What were you going to say?
What was the inspiration, and do you think you'll write another book?
Oh, I'm writing another book right now, but a totally different book. And it's about all the stories that I have been telling you. I'm going to put into a book. But, I mean, from the time that I was kind of in the third or fourth grade, because I've been dyslexic and ADHD all my life, so everything that I told you about these great directors, I also did with my teachers and my friends and cops and, you know, mothers and fathers and relatives. So it's just been happening throughout my life. I mean, I've had guns pointed at me and knives at my neck because I've said the wrong thing or had an attitude at the wrong time. I mean, I've had a very, I don't know about admirable, but very interesting life. It's just, you know, very book prone. So I'm writing that. But the book that I wrote that you're talking about, The Loopholes Dossier, I wanted to write a book. And I had enough, because I've been writing all my life. I just write. It's almost like a diary, but I do it through characters. And, you know, if something happens to me, generally I'll write a character about what just happened to me. So I don't use my own name. I just make Emmett Demas is my pseudonym. You know, if you see a character named Emmett Demas, you know, it's Larry Hankin kind of talking through the character. And I have a lot of film shots that I made for Emmett Demas, where he kind of rants at the camera or like this thing. But I also write fables, funny fables. And that character, also me, I mean, it's an enhanced me. I mean, the character of me does things that I wouldn't dare do. But he also does a lot of things I do or gets into situations that I've been in. But they also do their own thing. In other words, if I see I've done something that, boy, if I had pushed it a little further, I could have been either in a lot of trouble or it could have been really funny. So I'll push the character there. In other words, it's also a little therapy session and extension of reality, you know.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Super reality. So I have these seven. The first third of the book is the greatest part. That's seven. The seven fables of Sometimes Jones, and those are seven fables, but they're fables of the same character through seven stages of his life. From 15 years old when he ran away and became I can never remember this word. Every time I mention this, I forget it and then I remember it. The word, you know what the Dustin Hoffman was in Rain Man? Where he can count the number of toothpicks spilled on the floor.
Oh.
Like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
I can't think of the word for it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So this 15-year-old runs away from his father. Now, at 15, I always want to run away from my father. I never did, so I lived through the. So I wrote a story about a 15-year-old kid who didn't get along with his father and ran away. A savant. He was a savant pickpocket. he was the best pickpocket, and he runs away to San Francisco, and he joins all the pickpockets on Market Street, which is like, you know, Broadway or, you know, Santa Monica Boulevard. Joins all the pickpockets, and he became the best pickpocket on Market Street, 15-year-old kid. And then that fable is about, it's called The Magic Credit Card, where he's so good that he manages, through very cool means, sly means, he manages to pick the pocket of the President of the United States. And in the President's wallet is a card that grants you, it's a credit card for another life, one other life. It's a magic credit card. And in his pickpocketing days now, from then on, he's willing to take more chances than he's ever done because he's got another life right in his back pocket. And it's the exploration of a young 15, 16-year-old with that kind of power.
Mm.
And that's the fable. And it's a yin and a yang, you know, and it's kind of funny and it's satirical. and it has a moral. And then the next one is when he's 18 and he falls in love and that kind of fable. And then he gets married. There's that kind of fable. And then there's seven of them, finally, till finally he's about 55, 50, I think. And he finally runs away, in a way, to Tibet, to the top of this mountain. He becomes a monk. But he still has the same, I mean, you know, it's all different, but it's the same guy. It's the same guy. And so he has the same kind of problems that he had with the magic credit card and the divorce and the girlfriend and the monks and the Tibet, on the top of this snow-covered mountain. You see, wow, man, you know, you learn, but, you know, Dylan wrote in one of his songs, you know, every time you reach the next, every time you reach the top, you find out you're on the bottom.
The
next step.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I gotta get up, yeah. Okay, and, oh, shit. So, yeah, so that.
Well, it sounds very interesting to pick it up.
Is there any, no, wait a minute. What exactly did you ask me about what I just told you?
Oh, I just asked you what the...
Did I answer the question is what I'm asking you?
Yeah, yes, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, sir, you are one of the most recognizable character actors in Hollywood. You've worked with some of the biggest stars, and I wish you continued success, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you do next.
Well, me too, and thank you very much. But I didn't find out all that you just said about me until I started doing podcasts, and all this stuff started being brought up in questions. I never followed me. You know, I was just too busy getting the next job or doing my next project. So this is all... I mean, by now I know it, but but the last 3 or 4 months have been a big surprise to me. But I never knew I did 184 movies and TVs until it was brought up on a podcast. That's amazing. You know, I'm just busy doing what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah. You never stop to think, you know?
Excuse me?
Well, yeah. You never stop to think or look back.
Yeah. You're just busy doing, you know?
Yeah.
But those busy, what is that? Those aren't being busy. I don't know. What is that Dylan thing? Busy being or busy dying. You're either busy being or busy dying.
Yeah.
And I'm busy being, I guess. I mean, thank you, Bob.
Yeah, but you're always on to the next thing, which is why you have done so many, because you don't stop and look back. And.
I mean, I just want to get on to the next thing. I just want to get, you know, closure onto the next, But it took me a long time to learn that lesson. A lot of people learn it when they're 15.
Yeah. Well, sir, I want to thank you and...
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the interview and look for Friday the 13th, Part 5, A New Beginning, coming within the next 4 to 5 days.